We began last week a series studying the book of Daniel. We looked at Daniel chapter 1 last week, and right away we were introduced to a central tension of Daniel's story. He was taken into captivity by a powerful king, and this powerful king, Nebuchadnezzar, gave him a new name, gave him a new diet, gave him a new education. And all of these new things given by this new king were intended to form him into a new identity. And yet, Daniel is God's child. And nothing can take that away from him. And so the central tension that we will see revisited over and over and over again is how do I live faithful to the God whose child I am, and live amongst this new people with this new king? That is a tension that we see here, and I would say that this is a tension that you feel most days, if not every day. Just how do I live out my faith in the public sphere? How do I live out my faith if I'm a kid who's going to school and I'm surrounded by non-believers? How do I live out my faith in the public sphere? How do I do it at work? How do I do it at the park? What does that look like for us? This is fundamentally a wisdom question. And the encouraging thing about this story is that as Daniel is challenged with this tension yet again, he asks for wisdom and God gives it. God gives to those who ask. And he gives in abundance. It's a beautiful story. Let's look together. Daniel is a huge chapter, huge story. So we're going to bite off the first half this week and take on the next half after we get back from Easter. I'll read verses 1 through 23. In the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. His spirit was troubled and his sleep left him. Then the king commanded that the magicians, the enchanters, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans be summoned to tell the king his dreams. So they came in and stood before the king, and the king said to them, "I had a dream, and my spirit is troubled to know the dream." Then the Chaldeans said to the king in Aramaic, "O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will show the interpretation." The king answered and said to the Chaldeans, "The word from me is firm. If you do not make known to me the dream and its interpretation, you shall be torn limb from limb, and your houses shall be laid in ruins. But if you show the dream and its interpretation, you shall receive from me gifts and rewards and great honor. Therefore, show me the dream and its interpretation." And they answered a second time and said, "Let the king tell his servants the dream, and we will show its interpretation." And the king answered and said, "I know with certainty that you are trying to gain time, because you see that the word from me is firm. If you do not make the dream known to me, there is but one sentence for you. You have agreed to speak lying and corrupt words before me till the times change. Therefore, tell me the dream, and I shall know that you can show me its interpretation." And the Chaldeans answered the king and said, "There is not a man on earth who can meet the king's demand. For no great and powerful king has asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or Chaldean. The thing that the king asks is difficult, and no one can show it to the king except the gods, whose dwelling is not with flesh." Because of this, the king was angry and very furious and commanded that all the wise men of Babylon be destroyed. So the decree went out, and the wise men were about to be killed, and they sought Daniel and his companions to kill them. And then Daniel replied with prudence and discretion to Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, who had gone out to kill the wise men of Babylon. He declared to Arioch, the king's captain, why is the decree of the king so urgent?" And then Arioch made the matter known to Daniel, and Daniel went in and requested the king to appoint him a time that he might show the interpretation to the king. And then Daniel went to his house and made the matter known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions, and told them to seek mercy from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that Daniel and his companions might not be destroyed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. And then the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision of the night. Then Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Daniel answered and said, "Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, to whom belong wisdom and might. He changes times and seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and hidden things. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with him. To you, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise, for you have given me wisdom and might, and have now made known to me what we asked of you, for you have made known to us the king's matter." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Let me pray. You truly are the powerful one. You truly are the wise one. And yet I pray that you would show your strength and your mercy to us again this morning as we look to you and hear of this wisdom that you gave to Daniel. And I pray that you would help me, give me a clear mind, a clear heart of love for you and love for these friends. Be with me now. Help me to speak in ways that are in fidelity to your word, that honor you and serve your people. Would you help me in these ways? I pray in Jesus' name. Amen. So I read a fascinating article this past week. You might not find this fascinating. I certainly found it fascinating. What it was a chronicle of sorts of the path from the industrial age to the information age, the age that we now live in. Information age can mean a lot of different things depending on who's talking about it. This article and me are talking about it in this way. It just simply marks the transition from an industry-based economy to an information-based economy that began in about the mid-20th century, shortly after World War II. And what was interesting about it to me, I know you're all gripped, you're like, what was interesting about it to me was simply people that were watching this happen all along the way, especially in the first few decades of this development, and were making little, what you might call modern day prophecies about where they saw all this was going. In 1945, I mean, this is the year that that World War II ended, one person dreamed a dream. He said, "You know what we need?" This is Vannevar Bush, a man named Vannevar Bush. He said, "We need a central place to compile all human knowledge, cataloged and easily accessible for future generations." 1945, he said that. He envisioned the internet and Wikipedia at the same time. 1964, MIT professor. This is a man named Martin Greenberger who predicted that, quote, "computer services and establishments will begin to spread throughout every sector of American life." He said this when computers were like the size of Volvos, okay? They were very heavy and big, and they were only available to a few, but this is where he saw all this going. Here's the one that stood out to me. This is 1982. It's a journalist who's learning to type on his computer. He found working on his computer so much more enjoyable than working on his typewriter that he was used to. And this is what he said. He said, after noting all of these benefits, he noted a few consequences. He said, "Computers forever distort your sense of time. 10 minutes is now intolerable when everything else happened in a flash." He said, "It distorts your sense of time. It makes he is more familiar with impatience than he was before." And then he said this. He said it affected his relationships with the people he loved the most. He said, "My computer already competes with my wife and children for my affection. Can our family stand anything more?" That's what he said. What's his point? He's saying that for all the benefits of this new age, all the reasons it's good that we have so much knowledge, so easily accessible, all the connectivity that it offers us, all the convenience that it offers us. He was saying in 1982 that these technologies, having a computer in the home, will challenge his capacity for wisdom in a way that perhaps nothing else ever has. It will challenge our capacity for wisdom. It is very possible for us to be knowledge rich and wisdom poor. And we know this. We know this to be true. I mean, there's new studies and new research that surfaces what feels like every week, where somebody says that these new technologies, this information age that we're in, affects our ability to see our work with health, to see each other with health, to even see ourselves with health. That we can be knowledge rich and wisdom poor. And I would submit to you that when we look at the story, that is an equation for restlessness. It's an equation for anxiety, for fear, for worry. Because what do we have here? We have a king who can't rest without knowing what he doesn't know. And then you have all these experts in verse 2. It's the staff, the magicians, the sorcerers, the Chaldeans, all of those that won't live if they don't know what they don't know. And then what you have in the middle of it, standing kind of like a priest, is Daniel, who is the picture of peace, an arbiter of God's wisdom. Here's what I want to look at. First, I want to look at Nebuchadnezzar and see his restless search for peace. Sorry, restless search for wisdom. And then I want to look at Daniel and talk about his steady pursuit of peace. Nebuchadnezzar's restless search for wisdom, that's verses 1 through 13. And then you look at Daniel and you see a steady pursuit of peace in verses 14 through 23. Let's start with a restless search for wisdom. Let me ask you, do you ever stop and ask yourself, how did I get here? How did I get to this place? You're just frustrated with yourself or frustrated with somebody else. How did I end up in this place? There's this person that I love and really respect and admire, but for some reason we are just at odds with each other all the time. How did we get here to this place? I am so critical of everything that I encounter, of the people that I encounter, the things I read, the things I watch, the things at church. I'm kidding. How did I get to this place where I became so critical? Or I'm just angry. I'm just so easily angered. I have a frail spirit. And it seems like the smallest things can just spin me up. How did I get here? How did I end up on this downward spiral? Have you ever felt that way before? The reason I bring that up is because I would propose that what we're looking at in Nebuchadnezzar is a downward spiral. In verses 1 through 13, he starts in a disrupted state, and then he spirals downward into a desperate state. I'll talk about disruption, and then I'll talk about desperation. First, disruption. Everything's disrupted here for him. Verse 1 tells us that his sleep is disrupted, and that's a big deal. I know many of us feel like know that experience where we can't sleep, but in this case, his sleep is disrupted because his soul is disrupted. It's an inner consequence that he's feeling. There's just no peace, right? There's all inner turmoil. And his soul is disrupted because he's had a bad dream. Now, in this case, in the Babylonian culture, according to their mythology and according to their religion, if you had a dream, they were considered shadows of the future. They were portents of things to come. They were gifts from the gods that they could give you that have to be decoded in some way. But they're sending you a message. And this would be significant for any individual to have their dream interpreted in Babylon. But it's especially significant for a king to be able to have his dream interpreted because his dreams have significance for the entire nation. And so the king is restless at night. He can't rest until he figures out what's going on. Everything's been disrupted. And so he does what kings of the past have done, what the kings that followed Nebuchadnezzar have done, and he gathers up his staff. Interesting, Chaldeans. Chaldeans were known to be dreamologists. They had a whole library of resources, of past dreams, records, and then history that was, or think the history of what happened following these dreams that they could consult, kind of like legal textbooks that would give them precedent for interpreting future dreams and what might happen. And he says to them, I need for you to interpret this dream. Except that's not what he said. What did he ask for? He didn't just ask for the interpretation, he asked for the dream itself. Now, this is what you might call an unreasonable demand. Nobody makes that request. Nobody asks for the dream as well as the interpretation. And they said so. They said, what you are asking, no man can do this. It's a very telling statement in verse 10. No man can do this. Only the gods can do this, whose dwelling is not with flesh. That's an interesting thing that they said, isn't it? And so they appeal. They say, there's no way we can possibly fulfill your request. And there are a lot of theories. Well, not a lot. There are a few theories about why the king makes this unreasonable demand of his staff. Some people think that he forgot the dream. That's an interesting theory. He had the dream and then he forgot it. And that's a big deal, because in Babylonian culture, if the gods gave you a dream, you could be under the curse of the gods if you forgot it. Some people think that. They look at this this verse in verse 3, my spirit is troubled to know the dream. And they think that's what he's aiming at here. I don't know. That might be. We can't know that. But I think the simpler explanation is probably the best one. And it is simply that he has reached a desperate state, that he is panicky. He has reached it, and you see all the evidence of this desperate state in the king. You see first the unreasonable demand, and he attaches the highest consequences to that demand. You see, if you fail, you and your household will die. It gets pretty graphic, torn limb from limb in this passage. He has an unreasonable demand. He is uncompromising. You see that too in verse 5. The word from me is firm. It says that twice. He doesn't trust anyone. He has isolated himself. Verse 9, it tells us that he thinks that they're all conspiring against him. And when nobody is able to give him what he's asking for, in verses 12 and 13, he sends out a decree that all of the wise men of Babylon would be destroyed. He exacts a consequence that helps him not at all. He doesn't have the wisdom that he desires. And why is that? I really think the most simple explanation is that he doesn't trust these wise men of Babylon to be able to interpret his dream correctly. Only if they were able to somehow tell him his dream, the dream that he had, would he have the power, would he trust their power to give them the interpretation? The king is all alone in this way. He lacks power. And so he lacks peace. And he is as restless as ever. Let me ask you, what is the connection between wisdom and peace? We've seen it a couple of times already this morning. We've seen the connection between wisdom and peace made in our call to worship. We saw it in 1 Corinthians, which I'll reference later. And what we see here is a lack of wisdom and a lack of peace in this narrative. What's the connection between those two? Well, I would simply say that peace is what's at stake behind every wisdom question that we ask. I mean, think about it. Some of you are teenagers in this room. I can see you in here. And you're already asking wisdom questions. You're already asking wisdom questions about who I'm going to become. And maybe what school I'm going to go to. If you're in college, then you might be thinking about what degree that you want to pursue. Some of you are thinking about people, like who you want your friends to be. Or you know, maybe who you want to have a special relationship with. Like, you're thinking about these things. And then later, you might be thinking about who you want to marry. These are all wisdom questions. And what's at stake? It's the hope of peace, right? The future peace that you want to enjoy. Some of you many of you are working right now. You're thinking about your work. And many of us are in a place where we're wondering, like, should I keep doing the work that I'm doing? Should I keep doing it here? Or maybe think about doing it in another place? Or should I switch work altogether? What are the costs for that? These are wisdom questions. And what's at the heart of that? It's peace, future peace. Wisdom in money. How much should I be saving every month versus how much is it okay for me to spend? What's good for me to put in our entertainment budget this month? Those are wisdom questions that have a long range future peace attached to it. That's the connection. If someone in your life, maybe an authority or just a friend, asks you to do something that violates your conscience, what's at stake? Peace is what's at stake. How to wisely navigate that. Sinclair Ferguson looks at Nebuchadnezzar here in this passage and says, this is humanity's greatest insecurity. He says, as long as Nebuchadnezzar sought security and rest in possession or power or future reputation, he could never be content. Nebuchadnezzar, like so many people, had everything except the one thing that he needed most, peace. And look, I don't think anybody here is in danger. I mean, I just don't see that in you. I don't think anybody in here is in danger of exacting the kind of consequences that Nebuchadnezzar is employing here in this passage. But there are elements of what he's experiencing that I think we're familiar with. Fear of the unknown. Fear of the future. Fear that everyone is against you, or a particular person is against you. Fear driving us into isolation. Fear making us paranoid. Fear of the unanswered questions. It is hard to find wisdom when you're exiled by fear. Listen, there is a wisdom that the world offers. It will always be available to you. But it cannot deliver the peace that we long for. And there is a wisdom that God offers that promises peace eternal. One of the things that's interesting is that when the Bible talks about wisdom, it talks about peace right alongside of it. In fact, it describes God's wisdom, godly wisdom, divine wisdom, as a pathway to God's peace. Remember, God's peace is the word shalom. It's not just the absence of hostility. It's not just a time when there are no wars on the earth, although that sounds wonderful, especially in a day like today. But God's peace, shalom, is a description of human flourishing, where everyone seeks the peace of their neighbor, where everyone enjoys their own peace and seeks the peace of their neighbor. It's a description of human flourishing. And when the Bible talks about wisdom, it talks about it as a pathway to this peace. In Proverbs, I'll give you three examples. In Proverbs 3:17, it's a beautiful passage where wisdom is personified. It's described in the person of a woman. And he says, wisdom, this woman, wisdom, all her ways are pleasant and all her paths are peace. You see that? God's wisdom leads to peace. James 3:17. But wisdom from above, godly wisdom, is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, open to reason, full of mercy and good fruits. Here's another good one. This one, I think this is my favorite one. King Solomon. King Solomon was King David's son. He was heir to the throne of Israel, and his name is a derivative of the word shalom. He's literally the king of peace. And this was a big deal because David wanted to build a temple for the Lord. But the Lord said, no, you can't build a temple because you're a man of war. You've accomplished conquest and you've defeated foreign nations. I won't have that. What I'm going to do is have a man of peace build my temple. And so he has King Solomon, King Shalom, the one who presided over 40 years of tranquility for the nation. And when God visits him, this is 1 Kings chapter 3, when God visits him and says, visits him in a dream, which is interesting, he says, ask for me whatever you want. And what does King Solomon, the king of peace, ask for? Wisdom. And God grants him wisdom before he ushers his own people into the path of peace. There is a wisdom that the world offers, but it can't give the peace that we long for. And there is a wisdom that comes from God that establishes peace, and that's exactly what we see in Daniel in this passage. I would submit that when we look at Daniel, beginning in chapter 4, what you see is the undoing of all the rancor, of all the chaos, of all the craziness that this king has created, his restlessness. He was off balance. He puts everybody else off balance. See the chain reaction of restlessness. And then out of Daniel and moving forward that affects everyone else, What you see is a man who simply pursues peace by pursuing wisdom from the Lord. Listen, one of the indicators, and none of this is complicated, what Daniel does here. I mean, you might think that this is kind of cryptic, that we have to know some particular knowledge in order to have wisdom from the Lord. But I want you to notice how simple this is, what Daniel goes about doing in order to pursue this wisdom. The first is that Daniel pursues peace with poise. A wise person can live with poise in the midst of a chaotic situation. When all things are crazy, this person doesn't lose his poise. And you see that. The Bible calls it prudence and discretion. I just love what he does here. The guard comes to him, lets him know that the king is angry and all the wise men, including Daniel and all his friends, are going to die. And then how does Daniel respond? The first thing he does is he asks a question. He says, what's so urgent about all of this? Why the urgency here? It's a beautiful way of calling a timeout. Have you ever done that? Or ever had somebody do that to you? If you're spun up or you're with somebody else that's totally spun up and it's just crazy and all things are wrong. And then the person who brings peace to that situation is often the person that just kind of presses pause, lowers the temperature in the room, and just asks a question. Why is all this so urgent? What's at stake here? And that's exactly what Daniel does. He encounters this with great poise, and then what does he do? He carries himself with faith. What does it say here? It says he makes an appointment in verse 16, proposing to meet with the king to provide answers to the king's question. And notice that he does this before he even knows what the answers are. I mean, this is unbelievable. He says, okay, why is all this so urgent? He calls his time out, and then he goes and makes an appointment. What is he doing? He's buying time. I mean, this is extraordinary faith, but it's also very practically wise, because he sets a time in the future when the king can expect an answer to the dream and the interpretation. Daniel is living by faith. And some people might look at this and say, you know, he's really just putting himself in the Lord's hands at this point. But listen, living by faith isn't putting yourself in the Lord's hands. It's knowing that you're already in the Lord's hands. That all the circumstances of your life are lived out under the sovereign rule of God. And so whether God reveals this mystery to him or not, Daniel knows that he has a chance to deliver everyone if he simply, you know, sets a future time with the king and then goes and prays and asks the Lord for wisdom. And when he lives out this faith, he does it with friends. And I think this is an underrated and underappreciated element of the story of Daniel, is that Daniel is not alone. And notice that he uses their Hebrew names in this passage. You see him in verse 17. It's a little clue that they're living out their Hebrew identities together. Also notice that he uses the word companions to describe his friends. Now, this may be significant. I kind of think it is. It might not be. But that word for companions is only used twice in the entire New Testament. It's used in Proverbs chapter 2 and Malachi chapter 2. In Malachi chapter 2, it's in the section where God declares that he hates divorce because it's a rending of a companionship. A companion is used to describe close friendships, like a lifelong friendship. And that's what he's describing here. Listen, a wise person lives with poise, can bring poise, can lower the temperature in the room. A wise person lives by faith in difficult circumstances, and a wise person has wise friends, surrounds him or herself with real wisdom. And what do? Listen, it's simple. They get together and they pray to God for mercy. He gets together with his friends and they pray together. And then what do next? God gives them the mystery. Daniel rushes to the king's court to save the day. No. He stops and he prays to the Lord with a grateful heart. He prays as a prayer of gratefulness to the Lord. And notice what he says in verse 20. I'm grateful. Bless you, O Lord, for you are wisdom and you are strength. And then in verse 22, and you have made me strong, and you have made me wise. Listen, Daniel stands out in chapter 1. He stands out in chapter 2. But he stands out because he's simply employing the resources of his faith. And what's profound to me about all of this is that you see these things in Jesus. Just as Daniel lives out his wisdom and pursues peace for those around him, a peace that serves those around him, Jesus lives with great wisdom. In 1 Corinthians chapter 7, it says that he is, I'm sorry, 1 Corinthians chapter 1 that we just read earlier, it says that Jesus is the very embodiment of God's wisdom. When you're looking at Jesus, you see what it looks like to live out God's wisdom. And what does Jesus accomplish? He accomplishes your peace. Well, how do you see this? Well, time and time again, you see Jesus live with great poise. I mean, you could not push him around. Even when he's being asked questions in front of a lot of people that were designed to trip him up, you could not disrupt his poise. When he came up against powerful people that made all kinds of expectations on him, he could not be pushed around. He always knew who he was and lived with great poise. And boy, there were times where he answered a question with a question, right? He also is a man who lived by faith. I mean, every moment of his day was lived out in faith. John 6, he said, my whole purpose here on this earth is to do the will of my Father who sent me. And on the night he was betrayed, when he was in the garden, just before he was betrayed, he prayed to the Lord that this cup of God's wrath would be passed from him. And when God said no, he continued to live his life out of surrender, out of obedience and love for the Lord. And he was never alone. I mean, even he surrounded himself with close friends. And even when he was alone, it was to be with his Father. And finally, I would say that the cross of Christ is foolishness to the world. The world looks at it and says, what good could come of this death? And you and I look at it and say, by his blood, I have peace with God. Jesus' blood shed in his eternal wisdom pursues your peace. And you pursue wisdom in order to pursue the peace, your own peace, and the peace of those around you. Let me pray. O God of love, would you please equip us with your peace, with your joy and your strength as we hear these things and then we turn to your table to receive from you. And I pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.